The Honorable Chief Justice and Justices of the Supreme Court of Ohio. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session pursuant to adjournment.
You may be seated. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case this morning is 2019-54, In Re Ellis Jr. For the appellant, Mr. Hackett.
Good morning, Your Honors. Chief Justice O'Connor, may it please the court. I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, if I may. Your Honors, the fair, consistent, and reliable application of the criminal law is paramount to our system of justice. But without a true interpretive framework for very difficult cases like this, Revised Code Section 2907.02A1C permits arbitrary and selective decision making, which result in unprincipled and disparate treatment of persons throughout the state. Now, the crux of a vagueness case like this, unlike most other constitutional challenges, is precisely the unworkability of the status quo. And the analysis here really turns on two overarching considerations that are related, but I think are helpful to keep separate when we think about this issue. The first is what makes the statute unworkable in this particular setting? And the second is, based on that understanding, what do we do about it? What is the correct remedy in an as-applied vagueness challenge? Now, the statute here is unworkable and unfair, and prone to arbitrary decision making for several reasons.
How was anything that happened here arbitrary?
How was it arbitrary, Your Honor?
Right.
Well, Your Honor, so before even assessing the elements, what's problematic
what happened here that was arbitrary? You said was arbitrary. So what happened that was arbitrary?
So LS's intoxication was never meaningfully accounted for from beginning to end. As far as it goes, as far as the statute goes, it is not relevant to the court's consideration. The whole inquiry instead is based entirely on establishing the extent of only one party's impairment.
Was there evidence presented that LS was as intoxicated as RJ?
No, Your Honor, and that's actually part of the unfairness and the problem.
Why is that? Why was there no evidence as to your client's intoxication?
Yes, Your Honor. So Revised Code Section 2901.21 prevents the introduction of voluntary intoxication as a defense.
Well, I'm not saying that it was as a defense, but I understand that the testimony from the second male,
that's correct,
said that your client did not appear to be intoxicated.
The testimony from the co-defendant was that he did not appear to be as intoxicated as RJ. However, I think there could be a number of reasons for that. Now, I think the record does support, nevertheless, that he was impaired because the Court of Appeals recognized that he was clearly drinking and smoking marijuana. RJ herself testified that he had just as much as she did to start the beginning of the night. He was also drinking his own bottle of liquor on the walk home, and importantly, he also smoked a significant amount of marijuana throughout the day, which case law recognizes is itself a source of impairment.
Counselor, should your client's defense in the case matter to our analysis? His defense was, we had no contact. I did nothing, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. Below, he denied initially that there was sexual contact.
And counsel, he said that he refused RJ's advances.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay, and yet the DNA evidence would show to the contrary.
Mm-hmm. That's correct, Your Honor. We're not contesting here, and we did not contest below that that there was sexual conduct between the two.
If his defense is, I didn't do this, I didn't do anything, we had no contact, obviously I'm wrongfully adjudicated, how does that work in our analysis?
So I think that's getting to preservation-type issues. We raised this vagueness issue as a constitutional challenge to the statute on appeal. The Court of
Appeals— Did you raise it in the trial court?
I did not represent LS in the trial court.
Well, that's not the question. Was it raised in the trial court?
It was not raised in the trial court. As such, out of an abundance of caution, we raised this as plain error to the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals addressed this issue on the merits and resolved it on the merits. So the question for this court—
Well, listen, let me talk. How do we get to, if you didn't raise, part of your argument is you didn't have a chance to put on evidence that they were similarly impaired. But the reason you didn't have a chance to put on that evidence was because you never raised this issue in the trial court, right?
Trial counsel did not raise this issue. There would have been no reason for trial counsel to do that when it wasn't a viable defense.
There would have been if you want to raise something on appeal, you have to raise it in the trial court. That would have been a reason too, right?
Again, Your Honor, we raised this out of a plain error standard, and the Court of Appeals addressed the plain error issue and resolved it on the merits, which means for this court, this constitutional issue is preserved for review at this stage of the proceedings, because the question, again, is whether or not the Court of Appeals constitutional analysis was correct.
Well, but you can't argue that you didn't have a chance to put on evidence about them being similarly impaired when you didn't raise the issue. You didn't have a chance because you didn't raise the issue in the trial court.
Your Honor, it wouldn't have been a viable defense, again, because of 290120.
Well, it wouldn't have been a viable defense because he said it wasn't me. So it didn't matter how intoxicated he was or not intoxicated, his whole case was it wasn't me, right?
That's correct, Your Honor, but part of the reason, too, that this is problematic, again, we have to remember, so taking it a step back and thinking about LS's interview with law enforcement, and a question, a potential counterargument, I think, that goes along with this line of questioning is why didn't he mention his level of impairment to law enforcement? But we have to remember that we have a 16-year-old child who is not allowed to be drinking alcohol or smoking marijuana in the first place. There would be no reason for him to think that that was mitigating under those circumstances.
And that goes back to my question about him testifying that he refused her advances, okay? If he was so not substantially impaired that he could remember refusing her advances, then there was no equality of impairment.
Well, the record, again, it doesn't show equality of impairment, and I don't think, as briefed in the reply brief, equality of impairment is necessary here for the vagueness claim.
Okay, well, let's say substantially impaired. If he remembers refusing her advances, how could he have been substantially impaired?
He told the police that he refused the advances, and that wasn't, he didn't testify, Your Honor, so there was no—
It was in the record is the reason. But my point is, we're talking about, was he impaired enough to not know what he was doing, right?
Correct, yes.
But if somebody remembers that somebody else made advances to me, but I refused them, doesn't sound like they're very impaired to me at all.
Well, the veracity of his statements to law enforcement was never adjudicated. It was never put to the court. The court was never asked to determine the veracity of those statements because, again, he did not present that to the court. But going back to Your Honor's question about whether—
The reason he didn't present it to the court, well, in essence, he did because his defense was it wasn't me. And if anything, she was the aggressor, right?
Well, that she actively participated, yes, Your Honor, and there is indications in the record, particularly from the co-defendant, that she did actively participate in the sexual—
Well, understandably, she participated, but whether or not she was doing it with an impaired ability to consent is the question, and there's no question she was impaired.
Correct.
And there's no question that her consent, that her condition rendered her unable to consent.
Correct. There's no question that she was substantially impaired. I think bearing on that question, it's important to keep in mind, too, though, that he was acquitted of the forcible rape charges. And so the issue below was strictly this impaired consent statute. But not only is substantial impairment an element, even more problematic is the mens rea. And this mens rea is unique to this statute because it asks law enforcement to assess not just a child's knowledge of some concrete objective fact in the world, but rather the extent of a child's knowledge of somebody else's state of mind, of their level of impairment. And that's exceedingly difficult to do, given what we know to be true about children in general in the simplest
terms.
Was
she not carried into the house?
She was not carried into the house, no, Your Honor.
Carried to bed? Did I read that?
They helped her to bed, yes, Your Honor.
What does that mean?
The mother testified that she had helped her to bed.
Well, and LS also helped her to bed.
I think there was some conflicting testimony in the record as to his extent of involvement there. He was present in the kitchen.
Didn't he help her stand up while they were walking?
He helped her walk home. That's correct.
He could walk and she had some trouble walking.
That's correct, Your Honor. But again, I don't think we can overlook the fact that marijuana is also a source of impairment. So if he was not showing the same level of objective indicia of intoxication, he could still be substantially impaired, especially given the subduing effects of marijuana.
And if he would have put evidence on to that effect in the trial level, you would be on much firmer ground here.
There's no denying that we would be on much, much firmer ground. But again, I think hindsight is 2020, so we're kind of...
Well, I know hindsight is 2020, but there's also a basis for a challenge that flows through the trial court to the appellate court to us, and that basis was not made.
Well, we're not challenging the constitutionality of the voluntary intoxication statute. That might be a more direct way to do this, but... that statute and the inability to present that information adds to the unworkability and unconstitutionality of this statute. So granted, Your Honor, I think Your Honor's point is very well taken that a more direct challenge would have been to the voluntary intox statute.
Counsel, what evidence would you have us point to say he was not as impaired as she was? Let's just live with the evidence that we have.
Certainly.
What do you want us to focus on?
Well, I think as to his impairment, it's important that the Court of Appeals, their finding below was that it was clear that LS had been drinking and smoking, but that the state presented evidence that could support a finding that he remained able to recognize RJ's level of impairment. So there was no suggestion in the record that the facts were ever examined from LS's perspective. As to his impairment, I think the Court of Appeals took, if for the sake of argument, if for nothing else, that there was evidence of his impairment. And so you're right, Your Honor, the facts are, you know, what they are, and the record is what it is. I do think my opening point is important, that it's not surprising that the record is skewed as to the level of his impairment, and that's going to be the case in every single one of these prosecutions. Now, again, I think the more problematic piece, though, is the mens rea element. So we have substantial impairment on the one hand, and we focused a great deal about the evidence there, but another part of this statute, again, is the ability to assess a child's knowledge of another person's state of mind. In the simplest terms, what we know is that youthfulness affects behavior and perception. The amicus brief talks a good deal about the brain science as to why that is. And the Supreme Court has noted that children possess only an incomplete ability.
But counsel, going back to what happened at the trial court, you're saying that he ingested so much alcohol, he ingested marijuana, that his age and his ability to apprise the situation was not that of an adult. Why was there not evidence put on by an expert witness that could have taken all that into consideration and established the case without your client taking the stand under a hypothetical?
Yes, Your Honor. I can't speak to counsel's strategy in that regard. Again, I My best guess is that counsel didn't think that it was a viable defense. I mean, I think he did, in closing, suggest that, one, if RJ is to be considered substantially impaired, then LS should be considered substantially impaired, too. He made a vague reference to, again, this was in closing, I think we're kind of chasing our tails here. I, in briefing this on appeal, did not think that was a sufficient enough statement to not raise this under plain error, because it wasn't articulated as clearly as it should have been. So again, out of an abundance of caution is why we raised the issue on the plain error standard, and the Court of Appeals addressed it on the merits and resolved it.
Counsel, if I can ask just one slightly different question, and that is, was there any discussion of whether intoxication even means impairment? Was that issue raised at all?
It was. Below, Your Honor, yes, it was.
That it did qualify as intoxication. Did that make it to the Court of Appeals? That intoxication does equal impairment.
Impairment. Yes, Your Honor, it did. Below, at the Court of Appeals, we briefed a sufficiency and manifest weight argument, and initially challenged at that time whether or not there was sufficient evidence to conclude that substantial impairment, as opposed to mere intoxication, was demonstrated.
Thank you.
Yes, Your Honor. So, again, we've talked a lot about substantial impairment, and going to Your Honor's question, I think also contributing to the confusion of applying this statute is the fact that substantial impairment is underdefined, which means that there is no objective core, really, to this statute, and instead this central element, substantial impairment, is just determined moment to moment, case by case. This court has never defined substantial impairment due to drugs and alcohol. Interestingly, the State versus Zay case, which was not cited by either of the parties or the court below, but it was briefed below, it was cited below. The definition used in Ohio case law as the substantial impairment was borrowed from that case, which was a mental condition case. And there, this court recognized that there is no definition, and so the court relied on the ordinary dictionary definition of substantial impairment in the mental, regarded as mental retardation. And the issue there was that the child, the witness, suffered from—
Your time.
Thank you, Your Honor. We would just reserve the rest of our time for—
You don't have any time left. That's what I'm telling you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Ms. Rivas.
Chief Justice O'Connor, and may it please the court, my name is Barbara Rivas, and I'm an assistant prosecuting attorney out of Ottawa County. I'm joined at council table by James Van Erten, the Ottawa County prosecutor. We are here on behalf of Appalachia, the state of Ohio. The court accepted this appeal on the proposition that revised code section 2907.02A1C allows for the arbitrary and discriminatory enforcement of the law where the evidence demonstrates that two sexually involved teens are similarly impaired. In challenging the constitutionality of a statute, there can be a facial challenge or an as-applied challenge. A facial challenge requires no conceivable set of circumstances in which the statute is valid. It's not enough to say that under a possible set of circumstances, it would be unconstitutional. In contrast, an as-applied challenge requires clear and convincing evidence of a presently existing set of facts that make the statute unconstitutional and void when applied to those facts. As applied means there is an actual, not just a hypothetical, violation of constitutional rights. This was presented to the court as an as-applied challenge, and it is the position of the appellee that the presently existing set of facts does not indicate that the two teens in this case were similarly impaired. According to the testimony of the victim, RJ, she had two or three shots, followed by two half glasses of alcohol, liquor, then a water bottle that was full of liquor. She felt woozy, she was stumbling. She had to be helped home on her way home. She remembered certain events of the night, but then at a certain point she began feeling, in her words, really, really drunk. She remembered being put to bed, The rest of the night came back to her in snippets. She was still drunk and stumbling when she woke up the next morning.
Counsel, your friends on the other side say it really puts a defendant at a disadvantage if we're talking about intoxication equaling impairment, because he's not allowed to use intoxication as a defense. How do you respond to that?
Well, we would respond, we agree, and according to 290121, it does say that voluntary intoxication may not be taken into consideration in determining the existence of a mental state. However, it also says that evidence that a person was voluntarily intoxicated may be admissible to show whether or not the person was physically capable of performing the act with which the person was charged. So we would argue that it's not that voluntary intoxication can never be presented, just that it can't be an affirmative defense for the purposes of...
But under that definition, then you have to be so intoxicated that you basically are passed out yourself, or you can't keep your head up, or you can't have, you know, the balance to do anything.
That's correct. That's correct.
So how does that then, how do we then answer the question that's presented before us? If you have two intoxicated teens not appreciating what, you know, consent, lack thereof, or inability to, how do we do this analysis?
We would submit that in a situation, the statute says a substantial impairment. And substantial impairment isn't just they've had some alcohol or they've had some sort of
drugs. But substantial impairment of the victim.
Yes, yes. But for the question that was presented to the court, the situation is that they are similarly impaired. So in that situation, I mean, that's not the facts that we have before us today. That's not the situation that we have before us today.
What, you mean both parties being substantially impaired?
Correct. Or even similarly impaired.
Okay.
Right. But, I mean, if in a situation where both parties were similarly impaired and that impairment was substantially enough that whoever the victim was, unable to resist or consent, it would muddy the waters a little bit. But again, we would say that that's not this situation. That's not these facts before you today. RJ's mom testified that RJ couldn't walk straight. She couldn't walk without help. She was falling down. She sat at a table and fell out of a chair. LS and JC, who's the co-defendant, helped her up and helped her mother put her to bed. RJ smelled of alcohol. Jordan Carasalis, who was the co-defendant, stated that RJ seemed drunk because she could barely talk. She was falling over. She had vomited. He admitted that he pled because he knew that it was wrong to have sex with her in the state that she was in. In contrast, LS, who did not testify at court, one of the exhibits to trial was his interview with law enforcement. And in that interview, he admitted that he had had two shots, but he denied smoking, even though it was later found that he was probably smoking marijuana as well. RJ's mom said that he was very coherent. He didn't show signs of being intoxicated. She sat next to him and had a coherent conversation with him. There was no smell of alcohol. There was no stumbling. There was no slurring of speech. His eyes were not glassy. She didn't think he was drunk.
Counsel, the defendant says that we need to take into consideration what a teenager would be thinking at that moment. We're instead looking at evidence presented by adults saying, here's what we observed about his behavior. How do we blend those kinds of arguments? Are we looking just at the adult testimony? Are we viewing it from what a reasonable 16-year-old guy would be doing and thinking?
And if I may, the appellant would have this court adopt a reasonable juvenile standard when it comes to mens rea, and to take it from the facts and circumstances as LS saw them. And we would submit that when it comes to the situation, no distinction should be made between who was seeing things. It It didn't appear in this case, based on the facts of this case, that LS knew, or I'm sorry, that he didn't know how impaired RJ was. He was the one who walked her home. She couldn't walk straight. He was the one helping her up. She was sitting in a chair. Suddenly she was on the floor. He was the one who helped her up. He and her mom and the co-defendant, they all helped her to bed. So we believe that even if this court took into account the certain circumstances, or I'm sorry, the situation of his age, it was clear to anyone, whether you're 16 or you're 60, that she was impaired, that she couldn't consent.
So would you say that under no circumstances would we need to consider what a teenager would do in a certain circumstance?
No, we wouldn't go that far. We recognize that the Supreme Court, the United States Supreme Court, has adopted a reasonable juvenile standard instead of just the reasonable person standard. But we would note that that has only been confined to certain circumstances. So far, in terms of sentencing, in terms of, you know, whether someone is under, or whether a defendant feels that he or she is under custody for purposes of Miranda, that is when courts have determined that age can be considered. However, it hasn't been extended to mens rea, and we submit that this should not be the case to open the door for that. Even tort law hesitates when a child has engaged in adult activities. And we would submit that rape, crime involving sexual conduct, is the ultimate adult activity. This would not be the right place to adopt this standard, and this case in particular does not suggest, to the state at least, that a reasonable juvenile standard should be adopted for mens rea.
Counsel, let's assume RJ was substantially impaired, as found, right?
Mm-hmm.
If LS was substantially impaired, but not as substantially impaired as RJ, is it possible that he was not aware that the person, that RJ was substantially impaired? Assuming both were substantially impaired, but just of different values, different amounts.
Are you defining substantially impaired to meet the standard? Are you saying that if LS and RJ were both the substantially impaired in the statute?
But RJ more substantially impaired? Is it a fact then he might not have been aware that she was substantially impaired?
If he were, and again, that's not the facts as we see them, if he were substantially impaired, sufficiently impaired, that he, under the statute, he didn't have the ability to resist or consent, we would argue that in that situation, which again is not what we believe
you.
We have here, it would be very difficult.
Lead to the arbitrary enforcement that's being argued?
We don't believe so. We don't believe that would be...
Two drunk teenagers having sex, that's...
Because it's not just two drunk teenagers, it's two really, really, really drunk teenagers. And the situation that is in the proposition of law is that they're similarly impaired. If you have two exceedingly drunk teenagers, to have them similarly impaired would be very difficult. Because intoxication, it varies, you know, it's a male-female...
But the record has him, as you said, having cannabis, right?
It does.
So does that change the equation?
We don't believe, based on the testimony that we've seen, that he rose to the level of substantial impairment.
Okay, thank you.
But there's no, as you just finished with, there's no evidence that has been introduced that he was impaired, that he was substantially impaired here. There's, I guess, debatable evidence about how much marijuana he smoked, how much alcohol he had, et cetera. But going back to my question that I asked the appellant here, mm-hmm. Had there been expert testimony introduced about whatever he consumed, and do a hypothetical that way, you may get to his substantial impairment hypothetically. Correct? But that wasn't here.
Correct.
And nobody was saying that he was so impaired he didn't have the mens rea to have a sexual conduct with this victim.
That's correct. That's correct. And even in his interview with law enforcement, he didn't say, I didn't remember because I was drunk, or I was too drunk to know what I was doing, or I was too impaired, or I was too high, or anything like that. That wasn't his testimony. His testimony was, it wasn't me. She tried to kiss me. I turned her down. Nothing happened between us. That conflicted with what the victim said. That conflicted with what the co-defendant said. That conflicted with what the DNA said. We don't believe that in this situation that they were similarly impaired, and it was very clear.
How would that even be entered? How would the question of his impairment or intoxication, for that matter, be relevant if the only thing he says, it wasn't me?
That's true. I mean, if he's claiming that, he's not even trying to say that he wasn't capable of the activity. So he hasn't put forth anything that his intoxication or, you know, his, I guess, intoxication with drugs, that any of those wasn't, either of those was an issue. So I agree with you on that. Your Honors, if the statute in this instance is found unconstitutional under this set of facts, it sets a dangerous precedent in this court. It suggests that rape cannot be claimed, that you can basically, if you are a teenager, that you can commit rape, and if you claim that you were drunk, even if there isn't terribly much proof, that you can basically get out of it because the statute's unconstitutional as applied to you. If there are no further questions, the appellee would request that this court affirm the Sixth District Court of Appeals in this matter.
Thank you. Counselor, you used your time. You may take 30 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honors. Three very quick things. Firstly, the problem is that under the statute as written, a defendant's impairment is not relevant. There is no room for a defendant to introduce evidence or for the court to consider it. The second thing is, I think it's important that this is not a case in which one teen was passed out and unconscious and indisposed at the time of the sexual conduct. The observations made in the kitchen were 40 minutes before, and the co-defendant testified that she was fully awake. And then finally, I just want to note that JDB, in implementing a reasonable child standard, drew from all over the law, Fifth Amendment custody and confession, confrontation clause, tort law, and contract law. And so I think the argument that the reasonable child standard is simply confined to sentencing cases is not correct.
But then again, counsel, if his defense was, it wasn't me, never happened, how does his impairment, how is that relevant?
His impairment is not relevant under the statute, and that is the problem.
No, in he didn't even introduce or suggest he was impaired and couldn't appreciate, didn't have the mens rea to appreciate she was impaired. All that doesn't matter. His defense was, it wasn't me, I didn't do it.
And I submit to the court that he wouldn't have had any impetus to submit that evidence as the statute is written.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
We'll take the matter under advisement. You'll be notified of our decision.